And knock off as much of the rest of the list as we can. So there's a few Pesach. There are a few Pesach ones here, and although we're not close to Pesach time, these are all nice, cute little topics. So number one on the list is the three matzos are based on Kohen, Levi, and Yisrael. So I'm not really sure. There is a sefer which I originally put on the. I could only get it in a PDF format on Hebrew Books. I don't have the real sefer, so I didn't put it on the actual because it takes up half a page just that one quote. Because when you paste it out of a PDF, it doesn't. So I didn't put it on the list. But if you look on the first source, I gave you from the pasted it from the internet. I think a little quote from Elio Kito from the Sefer HaTodah, and they translated it into English. The Book of Our Heritage, the three matzot that are placed on the Seder plate are referred to as Kohen Levi Yisrael as a means of distinguishing them from each other. Meaning this is not an actual thing that they're based on Kohen Levi and Yisrael. Rather, it's just a way of identifying the different matzos. This was his take. There is, again, there's a Sefer Maisa Rokeach where he tries to assign certain significance to the matzos. But listen, I'm not that Kabbalistically inclined. I don't like a lot of the ex post facto Kabbalistic interpretations of, you know, the numbers and things like that, because if, as we'll see in a second, this was a big machlokas rishonim. So according to the Rambam and according to the Rif, we're only supposed to be using two matzahs. And it's known as the Shitas Agra. But it's not the Shitas Agra, it's the Shitas HaRif HaRambam. Now, nothing against the Gra, I'm a big fan of the Gra, but L'maisa, in the end of the day, it's actually, you could argue, the majority Shita in Rishonim. If you look in the Baalei Tosfos, there is a Tosfos in Brachos that seems to indicate you're only supposed to be using two matzahs. There's a Tosfos in Psochim, not so clear, but yeah. So this is the issue. So this is the issue that they're struggling with. Meaning, if you look in the Rambam, you see the Rambam, the second source there? It says, you wash a second time, which is the big question. Why do you have to wash a second time? You already washed. So he says, because you had a Hesach Hadas the first time. That because you had a long Haggadah reading, even if you don't have such a long Maggid, so you can't, I don't think anybody goes for less than an hour. So you had a Hesach Hadas, v'lokeach shnei rikikin, you take two matzahs, cholek echad mehen, notice the Rambam's yachatz is right before you make the bracha. You break it, umeniach parus l'toch shalem, and you take the broken one and you put it inside, because remember we're dealing with soft matzahs here, not just for Sephardim, for everyone. And, I mean, I'm not saying you should do that nowadays because they're very high maintenance. Soft matzahs are very high maintenance nowadays. They get stale in like 10 minutes. So anybody use them? You use them? No? Yeah, so like it's not. Like 1 year I was going to do it and they're so expensive and like it's just not worth it. Like the guy was giving me all these detailed instructions. This is when you defrost them. This is when you put them in the oven. What? No, it's an everyone thing up until a certain point in time. My sister used to put them in for the sink. Okay. And they're also very expensive, so they if you're paying the same price that you would for, you know, a box of matzahs, you're paying for one matzah, so then you're not so interested in using them the whole Pesach. So, but L'maisa, everybody at a certain point was using soft matzahs, and then they switched over to the crunchy matzahs because they're just much easier to deal with and people were not interested in baking matzahs on Pesach. There's a lot to say about it, but not for now. So he says, you put the parus inside the shalem, umavarach hamotzi lechem in aretz, and you make the bracha, umipnei ma eino mavarach al shtei kikaros kishar yamim tovim. So this is your question. Don't you need two? Mishum shenemar lechem oni, ma darka shel oni, beprusa afkan beprusa. So he says, just as a poor person does not have an entire loaf of bread, they have part of a loaf of bread. So too, we're supposed to make a bracha on a broken matzah. You're not supposed to make a bracha on a whole matzah. And the Rush disagrees. The Rush quotes the issue as well. And I just underlined the last. You can read the rest of it on your own. But he says, Hilkach noagua am laso sholosh matzos. Right? This is the minag was to use three, because on one hand you have lechem mishneh, on the other hand you have lechem oni, you don't really know what to do, so you have to have three with one of them broken, because otherwise you're not going to have lechem mishneh. That's why those who use three matzahs are very makpid to not have the third matzah in their hand when they make the bracha of al achilas matzah, because then it's really a question. There's also an issue of osim mitzvos chavilos. But you say, well, what's the big deal? Everyone should just do like the Rush. The big deal is, if you have three matzahs, think about it. The whole idea of lechem oni is you're supposed to have less, so you have more? It's a little bit of a contradiction. This is another example of what we call a chumra habali de kula, that it's a situation where you're trying to be strict, so you want to be strict on the halachos of lechem mishneh, but you're also being lenient on the laws of lechem oni. So the Rambam and the Rif, they hold that you're supposed to only have one and a half. That's lechem oni. You have less matzah than you would normally have bread on a given holiday. But the Rush says, yeah, but you see, you can't forego the issue of hamotzi, and therefore you have to have two and a half matzahs. Okay, so this is a machlokas, a legitimate machlokas. And l'maisin, the end of the day, the Rush has a tremendous mazel when it comes to the Leil HaSeder. Normally the rule with the Shulchan Aruch is that he tries to paskin, between the Rif, Rambam, and the Rush, he tries to paskin two out of three. It's one of those rules that's a very good rule, except when it isn't. So this is one of the cases where it isn't. Yeah, the Rush, I think, kemat everything on the Leil HaSeder, the Rush wins. The Shulchan Aruch paskins everything like the Rush over the Rambam in these cases, and the Rif. So this is another time where both the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah agree that you're supposed to use three matzahs. The Vilna Gaon is famous for saying, what happened to the perhaps majority sheet in Rishonim? That's more correct, which is you're only supposed to use one and a half matzahs or two matzahs. So, okay. That's the story. There are those who use two matzahs, there are those who use three matzahs, but to say that it has to do with Kohen, Levi, and Yisrael, again, this is us being privy to depths of Torah to which it seems the Rishonim were not. To me, that smacks of stupidity at best and lacks authenticity at worst. So, okay, listen, there are those who would just call me an apikoros for saying that, but that's okay. All right, let's go further. What else do we have here? Oh, number 11 is one of my favorites. Chametz means crumbs. Chametz means crumbs. When we do, and more importantly for us, this is a cute story. My daughter asked me this past Pesach. She said, if chametz means crumbs, how do we have matzah on Pesach? Because matzah makes so much crumbs. So that's a valid question, given the assumption that chametz means crumbs. So I don't know why people think that chametz means crumbs. It means, you know, as we know what it is, it means chametz. It means, bread products, unleavened products, whatever that, you know. Or leavened products, sorry. But the more important thing is the second part. When we do bedikas chametz, we're searching for crumbs. Now, this is also something that I think became popular because we clean the house so well before we do bedikas chametz. So everyone asks the question, what on earth are we even doing? Right, what are we doing bedikas chametz for if we already clean the house? So that's a fair question. But nevertheless, we're not looking for crumbs. And I can prove it from a very well-known Gemara on Vav Amid Beis in Maseches Pesachim. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, Abodik Tzarech Sheyivatel. So this is the Takana Amid Derabanan. It's discussion in the Rishonim. Is bedika doraisa, is bitl doraisa. Whichever one you do first, perhaps, is doraisa. So we say, but there's a Takanas Chachamim, in the name of Rav, that you have to do bittul. You must. My taima, if you're going to say, what's the reason why you have to do bittul? Inema mishum pirurin, if you're going to say it's because of crumbs, ha lo chashive. They are not important, meaning they are not considerable in the sense that if you were to find crumbs on Pesach, you would not be in violation of bal yirah, bal yimatzah. You would not be in violation of the isser of owning chametz on Pesach. Now that does not mean, let's be very clear, it does not mean that it's mutter to eat crumbs on Pesach. You may not eat breadcrumbs on Pesach. You may not own a kezias of breadcrumbs on Pesach. So if you have one of those containers where they sell breadcrumbs, you're not allowed to have that. It's definitely chametz. But what I mean to say is, we're not looking for stray crumbs here and there when we do bedikas chametz. And then the Gemara has another possibility, maybe it's minter lahu agav beise, which means that since you're not going to let someone break into your house and steal anything, meaning let's say a person says to you, I want to break into your house, I'm an expert, you know, at picking locks, I'm going to pick the lock to your house, I'm going to come in unannounced, and I'm just going to steal one plastic cup, and then I'm going to leave. So you'd be like, that's not acceptable. You're not allowed to. If you break into my house and I catch you, even if you're only there to steal one plastic cup, I'm going to call the cops. That's called minter le'agav beise. I'm guarding the house, so mamela, I'm guarding everything that's inside the house. So you say, maybe the crumbs have chashivas because I would never let somebody come into my house just to steal the crumbs. So the Gemara says, no, it's not true. They prove it from a braisa that it's not true, that the concept of minter le'agav beise is not enough to consider it b'yirav b'yimatzei for owning crumbs. And then the bottom of the page, Amar Rav gzeira shema yimatzei gluska yafa v'daito ilave. Maybe you're going to find a very nice roll, a very nice donut, piece of chametz, and you're going to then be happy about it. You're going to think about it and be say, oh, look at that. I'm so happy that I own that delicious looking roll. And then you're going to be in violation of b'yirav b'yimatzei at that point. So therefore, we're doing bedikas chametz to find real chametz. We're not doing bedikas chametz to find crumbs. We're not doing bedikas chametz to find 1/10 of a pretzel rod. We're doing it to find a gluska, yafe, and the like. We're doing it to, and again, this is why we do bittel, but the Gemara seems to say very clearly that the only way you'd be in violation of bayirah bayimatzeh is if you found real good-looking chametz, not something which would be considered that you'd sweep it up and throw it away anyway. Now, that being said, again, you're not allowed to eat crumbs. I want to be very, very clear. Crumbs of bread are, in fact, chametz for the purposes of eating. And if they were to, I'll give you a good example. Rav Moshe Feinstein holds that you don't have to look through your sfarim before Pesach. There's a famous chumra that the Chazon Ish had, which was that he wouldn't use his sfarim on Pesach because he held that they may have crumbs inside of them, and therefore he doesn't want to open up to a page that has crumbs inside of it. So he basically put away all of his sfarim before Pesach. They said that the only thing he had was a little Shas, a little Rambam, and the Tshuvas Dovid Misharim, which were written by the Chabina Rav. So somebody mentioned the Chabina Rav at that time was living in Yerushalayim, so they said, oh, you see the Chazon Ish, that's the only Shas and a Rambam in your Tshuvas. It's unbelievable. So he said, no, it's just a riot. He doesn't read them the rest of the year. So because if he would read them the rest of the year, he wouldn't. He says, Shas and a Rambam, okay, what can you do? You need it. But my chuvas, he says, once a year he gives it a glance. So anyway, that's the sheet of the Chazon Ish. But the Rav Moshe held that you don't have to search through your sfarim for crumbs. He says, but if it's a Haggadah and it's going to be on the table, and let's say you spend a month before Pesach looking up good vorts on the Haggadah, so you're sitting at the Shabbos table with the Haggadah, so maybe it has real breadcrumbs inside. So what's going to happen? You're going to open up the page, and the breadcrumbs could fall out into the soup. And chametz is not batel on Pesach, and therefore you might be in violation of eating the chametz. So that's why those are the sfarim you have to check. Again, because you can't eat the crumbs. And not only can't you eat them, but if they fall into real Pesachtika food, it's going to make it not, you know, it's going to make it chametz. And therefore you have to be aware that there are no crumbs on, you know, surfaces that one might eat food, but there's no chiyuv to, let's say, pick up your mattress for fear that, you know, maybe somebody snuck some cookies into the bed. I know when I was a kid, there was Ernie and Bert. I think Bert was always angry at Ernie for sneaking cookies into the bed. So you don't have to be afraid that the kid snuck cookies into the bed, and therefore now the cookies are under his mattress, and he's going to somehow consume them on Pesach. That's not anything. You want to have a clean house, feel free to check for, you know, cookie crumbs under the bed. But that has nothing to do with Pesach. Don't blame Hashem for that. That's just your own desire to have a clean house. That's not, you can't blame the Torah for spring cleaning. Spring cleaning is one thing, and bedikas chametz is something else. You know, bedikas chametz means you're looking for actual pieces of food, not dirt. My mother used to, perhaps she still does, I don't know. She used to, you know, like go through our closets and say, look at this, pure chametz. It was dust, it was dirt, it was not bread, it was not, you know, it could be that it was once upon a time breadcrumbs, I don't know, but everything that was dirt was labeled as chametz, so that's not an accurate statement in terms of halacha. Okay, what else do we have here? Anything else on Pesach? Yeah, that was it? There's got to be a lot more for Pesach. Okay, so let's do number six. Esav bit Yaakov instead of kissing him, but his teeth broke. Anyone ever heard this before? Yeah. My kids all tell this. His neck turned to marble. So let's just take a look. Yeah, Vayishakeh with dots on top, right? So take a look at source number six. Vayoretz Esav lekrasov vayichabekehu vayipol al tzavarav vayishakehu vayivku. So he says, this is when they meet. Esav runs to Yaakov, he hugs him, he falls on his neck, he kisses him, and he cries. So Rashi points out that in the Sefer Torah itself, there are dots on top of the word vayishakehu. So he says, number one, yesh cholkin bedavar. There are those who debate the matter, the b'raisa of the Sefrei, in the Medrash. Yesh yedarshu nekudazu lomar shelo nashku b'chol libo. There are some who say that it means he didn't kiss him with his whole heart. Meaning, generally speaking, the way that the Chazal understand dots on top of a letter is the dots are there to weaken the word. They're there to weaken the word. There's a lot to say about it. There are other midrashim that say something very, very different about dots on top of a letter. We're not going to get involved with that. But he says he didn't kiss him with a full heart. And then Amar Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, Ben Yochai, halacha hi biyadua. Such an interesting lashon. He says it is a known halacha she Esav soni liYaakov, that Esav hates Yaakov. It's a halacha. Ela shenikmeru rachma b'osa shav v'nashka b'chol libo. At that moment, he kissed him with his whole heart because he was so moved by Yaakov's gifts and his bowings and etc. etc. So Rashi, who is the number one quoter of midrashim in the standard mafarshim on Chumash, does not quote such a midrash that Esav bit Yaakov. Rather, he quotes two opinions in Tanoim, both of which say that he kissed him. And in addition, it's a machlokes whether or not he kissed him with his whole heart or whether he kissed him half-heartedly. Okay, but in the end of the day, the standard pirish on Chumash, which is Rashi, in the end of the day, there are other amazing mafarshim on Chumash, but Rashi is the first stop for all Jews, you know, is Rashi. And he does not quote such a medrash. But if there is such a medrash, if you look in Targum Yonasan, he does quote the medrash, and they have the English, the Hebrew translation over there, Keser Yonasan. Urahat Esav likdamuse v'gafifle v'isrikin al tzavarei u'nesheikle v'chon Esav bach al tzavarei d'shino d'ish mizu v'yakov bach al tzavarei. Right, so he says, what happened? Why did he cry on his neck? So he says, right, where is it here? Altsar shinov, right? So he says, the pain of his teeth that got ground up, that broke. And then he writes in parentheses, Esav bikesh linshoch es tzavaro shel Yaakov et tzavaro hafach l'shayish. Right, so he says he wanted to bite him and his neck turned to marble and he bit him. So this is, so listen, for me to tell you that this is not a real, it is a real medrash. It's a real, you know, it's something that's written in Targum Yonasan. It's not a joke. But this is a general question of really elementary school chinuch. I don't claim to know the answer. I'm not even an expert in the type of chinuch that I do, but I'm certainly not an expert in elementary school chinuch. But one thing I've noticed is over the years, I just brought this one example, but you can give tens of examples of going away from the more classical pirushim on Chumash and finding the wildest, craziest midrashim you can to explain any and every incident that ever happened in Chumash. I don't necessarily think that this is a good thing. I'm not saying this with any expertise. I'm just saying I find that the mainstream Torah is a very good thing. It's not, so you don't need to run to craziness and Bubba Mises and Rebbe Mises about everything to get kids excited about Judaism. And then you have a lot of kids who get very turned off by this stuff when they wake up at the age of 9, 10, 11 and they realize, hey, none of this stuff is actually going on. And then they open up an actual book written by Hashem, the Torah, and they say, it doesn't say any of this stuff in the Torah. Meaning that the way they teach kids nowadays, you cannot tell the difference between what it says in the Torah and what it says in one crazy medrash. That's all Pashup Shad and Chumash. You know, it's all the same. And it's just, I'm not saying you have to learn everything Pshuto Shel Mikra. You know, maybe we'll talk about that next. But and you have to go straight Rashbam Ibn Ezra on everything. I'm not saying that. Rashi quotes a sufficient amount of Midrashim for people to, you know, get their fill of Mamari Chazal. You don't need to go then forsake the Midrashim that Rashi quotes for wilder Midrashim and crazier stories. And it's just, it's not, I don't know that this is good for kids per se to be, you know, pumping them full of the wildest, craziest, most miraculous stories, you know, and then just to say, well, how come I never see it? Ah, be quiet, right? How come, you know, how come it doesn't say that? Be quiet, right? It doesn't, I don't think it helps people necessarily. Right. No, there are real midrashim that discuss all these things. I'm not, you can look it up, all the different midrashim. I'm not getting involved with what's what. I'm not saying you shouldn't tell stories of Avraham Avinu. I'm not saying, and a lot of them are very important, but what happens is that the lines between what it actually says in the Torah and even the mainstream midrashim get very blurred, you know, between, there's a lot of important discussions in the Ramban and in Rashi about which midrashim, you know, why, especially the Ramban has a question, and some of the more modern Sforum that discuss, you know, they saw a piece in the Siv Seichaim, which is a very nice piece, about this topic is analyzing the Ramban and why the Torah quotes some midrash, why the Torah quotes some stories about the Avos and not other stories about the Avos. If they're all true, if there's a true story, then why is it that the Torah just leaves it out? So, all right, he has his mahalach in the Ramban, whatever it is. I'm not suggesting that it's not a good mahalach, and I'm not even saying there isn't a place for good stories. You know, there isn't a place for good stories in the area of Chinuch HaBanim. There's a lot of room for great stories and stories that will instill your Shemayim. But first of all, they should be, you know, you should differentiate between, you know, this is a story and this is Torah. This is a wild medrash. This is a more mainstream medrash that's quoted in the Rishonim, and this is what it actually says in the Psukim. Kids are smarter than we think, and we give them very little credit when we just pump them full of wild stuff, you know, and it makes my life more difficult at some point in time when we try to teach them more, you know, mainstream Torah learning, and they're used to just more and more wild stories, you know, and that's not what 99% of Torah is, not that, you know, so I think it's not necessarily helping them in the long run. Again, I don't know that I'm right. I just, this is the feeling that I get. Okay. What else do we have here? So along those lines, number 10, Rashi is pshat. This is a phrase that was taught to me by many people. Rashi is pshat. And then the follow-up, pshat means the simplest interpretation of the pasuk. So I'm not going to go through the Rashbam right now with you. I gave you a piece of the Rashbam in source number 10. I gave you the Rashbam's famous quote, where he said, I spoke to my grandfather extensively about this, and my grandfather said if he... you're familiar with this Rashbam? Yeah, so you know the piece. Oh, you never heard of it? So basically, Bekitzer, he writes that I spoke to my grandfather about this issue. The Rashbam was the oldest grandson of Rashi, I believe. Rabbeinu Tam was his much younger brother. Rabbeinu Tam was what was his real name? Anybody know? Yaakov, right? It's Yaakov Ish Tam Yosheva Olim. So he says Rabbeinu Tam was much younger than the Rashbam, and the Rashbam learned a great deal with Rashi, and the Rabbeinu Tam I don't think did. But nevertheless, the Rashbam said in a conversation that he had with his grandfather about how to properly learn Chumash, he said, my grandfather admitted to me that if he had the time, he would like to write an additional pirush on Chumash, which is only based on Pshuto Shel Mikra, meaning only based on explaining the text from the text. Meaning, what we call pshat in terms of explaining Chumash or explaining Tanakh really means explaining the text using only other psukim or context or things like that, not introducing outside sources to explain the pshat and to explain what the chumash is talking about. That's what we mean when we say pshat. Pshat is a style of pirush on Tanakh where you use the words. doesn't mean you only just read the pasuk and that's it. It means you use a knowledge of all the pasukim in Tanakh, a global knowledge of Tanakh, you use a contextual knowledge of Tanakh, and you understand things from that perspective. And that's really what Chazal mean when they say Eina Mikra Yotzei Midei Pshuto, that the plain meaning, not the simplest meaning. Sometimes a Midrash will tell you a more simple interpretation than the words connote. Right? I'll give you a very easy example. What was the great sin of Reuven? That, right, so the Torah doesn't say that he moved the bed. The Torah says Vayishkav, that he lied with, right, with who was it, Bilhah, right? He lied with Bilhah. So what does that mean? So if the pshat is a wild thing to say, and then the medrash says, no, calm down there. All he did was this minor sin, which because of who he was and because of the climate and everything that was going on around it, was treated by the Torah as a much bigger sin. We find the same things with the sons of Eli, right? It says the same thing by the sons of Eli, where the pshat is wild. It's very, very, condemning. And the drash, it calms it down. It says, just back off a little bit, and it's not as bad as you think. And that's the Gemara's comment, Kolor Omer Reuven Chata Eino L'Toa. If you get bored one day, Rav Avigdor Nevenzahl has a beautiful piece on that statement of Kol Omer Reuven Chata Eino L'Toa. I think it's at the end of his Sefer on Bereishis. But it analyzes the three different opinions in the Gemara, and it says, what does it mean that if you think Reuven sinned, you're mistaken. You're not mistaken. He did, in fact, sin. So what actually does that statement of Chazal mean? But the bottom line is, that's an example of where pshat is not the simplest explanation. Pshat is the crazier explanation. Drash is a much, quote-unquote, simpler explanation in the sense of what happened was less wild, but it's not true to the text of the words, right? As opposed to pshat, which is true to the text of the words, whereas the drash introduces, additional facts. A lot of times Rashi will say, he'll have a pshat. Rashi always starts with a pshat question. That's why people say Rashi is pshat. He always starts with a pshat question. If you read, even if you can't figure it out yourself, if you read Sifsei Chachamim, if you read Gur Aryeh, or any of the, hundreds of Pirushim on Rashi, there are literally, I think, over 100 Pirushim on Rashi, predating this generation. Could be there are more now. But there are over 100 Pirushim on Rashi, and if you read them, you'll see, like, they always tell you what is bothering Rashi, what textual issues is Rashi dealing with, not just like, oh, that can't be true. If there are issues in the Pshuto Shel Mikra that bother Rashi, just Rashi chooses to solve a lot of those textual problems by introducing facts from a Midrash or something like that that explain why the Torah says it the way it does. Right? So there's very little that ever escaped Rashi's eye. There's very little that Rashi did not have a question on that was worthy of being questioned. And Rashi, when he has a question that he doesn't know the answer to, he tells you, I don't know what this means. I have a question here. I don't know. Sometimes you have to try to figure out what the question is. Sometimes they'll say, like, I don't know how to explain this, and you're not really sure what was bothering him so much. But there's always something bothering Rashi in the sense that he is dealing with a pshat issue, and then he will bring in a medrash to try to explain how you can resolve the issue. Whereas other Rishonim will say, no, we're not going to resolve this using Midrashim. We're going to resolve this using the text itself. We're going to use context. We're going to use other psukim that seem comparable. Right? That's more of a pshat approach in that sense. Okay. What else? All right. Move forward to the realm of halacha. You may hint to a goy to do malacha for you on Shabbos. Right? So, what is that all about? Hinting to a goy to do malacha for you on Shabbos. So as we know, they're one of the isurim derabanan of Shabbos is amira le'akum or amira le'nachri, however you want to say it. It is only an isur derabanan. There is a d'oraisa version of this. The d'oraisa version of this would be if you live amongst a ger toshav, if you're in Israel, you live with a ger toshav, there's actually an isur d'oraisa to tell a ger toshav to do malacha for you on Shabbos. So the irony of the situation is, if you were living in Israel during the times where the Jews were doing what they were supposed to do, the only non-Jews who were living among them couldn't be the Shabbos goy anyway. So that's unfortunate. The only way you could benefit from a ger tosha of doing something is if he totally did it for himself, and then you happen to benefit from it. Let's say ger tosha walks into the room and turns on the lights for himself, and then you walk into the room following. You're allowed to say, "Please don't shut the light." You know, you're allowed to ask a non-Jew not to do a malacha. That's okay, but you're allowed to. So then you could benefit from it, but. Barring that, there are very few heterim to ever ask a ger toshav to do a malacha for you. But nevertheless, it's become very, very common to use a Shabbos goy to circumvent the issur derabbanan of amir la'akum. So if you just look, it's a very short inyan in Shulchan Aruch. If you just look in source 17, it quotes from Aruch Chaim Simon Shin Zayin Sif Kaf Beis, right? So if you look in the Ramah over there, Haggah, you see, I underlined it. Kol davar she'asur lomar leino yehudi la'asoso b'shabbos, asur lirmoz lo la'asoso. Anything that you're not allowed to tell a goy to do for you on Shabbos, you're also not allowed to hint to him to do for you on Shabbos. Aval mutar lirmoz lo la'asos malacha achar Shabbos. Good news. You can tell him on Shabbos, you can hint to him on Shabbos, please, after Shabbos is over, do this malacha for you. So that doesn't really do you that much good. But let's look in the Mishnah Berurah Sif Kat 9 Vav there. Degam ze bechlal amir leino yehudi kevan sha'ayidei remizaso ose b'shabbos. Right, you're going to get him to do malacha for you on Shabbos anyway, so that counts as amir la'akum. V'uadin she'asur lomar lor b'shabbos ezer davar she'yavin mitoch kach she'yaseh malacha. You're not allowed to just say something to him conversationally and he'll understand through that that you will do malacha, that he's going to do a malacha. Va'alkein asur lomar leino yehudi she'yikaneach chotmo kadesh yavi sheyavin sheyaser apecham sheberosh haner o kishe omer aramiza o kishe omer aramiza leino yehudi shelo b'loshen tzivui. I'm sorry, ach. It's very important. So put the comma after haner. Then ach kishe omer aramiza leino yehudi shelo b'loshen tzivui. If you hint to the non-Jew in a way that you're not commanding him to do anything, kigon sheomer haner eno meir yafe. This candle is not giving off a lot of light. I can't use this candle, I can't read in here because there's too much charcoal blocking the flame. Then it's mutter for you to, you know, for you to benefit from it. He says, if the non-Jew does it for you, then it's not so much hana. Listen to this. Because you could have read using the lesser light of the candle, and therefore when he made it a little better for you, he didn't really give you that much hana. This is the one time where it's mutter to hint to a goy that the Mishnah Berurah is outlining. Meaning, just to back up, let's see. We have a couple of minutes, so let me give you a little bit of background. How familiar are you with the basis for Amir La'akum on a scale of 1 to 10? 10 being completely knowledgeable in all areas, 1 being I don't even know what it is. Right? All right, so thanks for that. I'm going to go with what?
3-4.
Okay. So there are basically three main reasons quoted in the Rishonim for the Isser of Amir La'akum. One of them I don't really understand so well, but I'll tell you what it is anyway. One of them is, the main issur is hanah from a maisa Shabbos. When there was you're not supposed to be getting hanah from an act that was done on Shabbos, from an act of malacha that was done on Shabbos. That's the main issue as far as I can tell. There's a secondary issue of yesh shlichus lenachri lechumra. Generally speaking, we say that a non-Jew is not considered a shaliach in halacha. So therefore, but l'chumra, certain times we say that we're afraid that the non-Jew is like a shaliach. And the third reason is v'daber dover. You're not supposed to be speaking about malachos on Shabbos, and you're not supposed to be bringing up these types of topics on Shabbos. You're not supposed to be talking about all the malachos you're going to do after Shabbos and all the it's not Shabbostic, as they say. Right? So those are the three main reasons I think that are quoted in the Rishonim. So by hinting, you circumvent one of the three. You circumvent the shlichus aspect, right? I guess you kind of circumvent the daber dover also, right? If you basically say to the non-Jew, the lights are off, thereby making it very difficult to read, right? Or I can't see a thing in here. You know, something like that. So that's what we call remiza shelo b'derech tzivu. You're not telling them to do anything. In order to make somebody a shaliach, you have to tell them to do something. If you don't tell them to do something, they're not your shaliach, right? Let's say I was in the city, I went to a wedding last night. So let's say you're allowed to get married al yidei shaliach, right? The Gemara says not to do it because mitzvah bo yosem b'shlucho. You're really supposed to do it on your own, but nevertheless, there's an additional reason why not to do it because it's a bad, bad idea. So you know, I'm not a very romantic person, but I still understand that you should probably show up to your own wedding. So the bottom line is you can get married al yidei shaliach. But let's say you say to your friend, do you want to be your shaliach? You say, you know, I really like this girl. I think I might even want to marry her. And then he goes off and is mekadesh her on your behalf. That doesn't help. You didn't give him a tzivui. You didn't tell him what to do. You didn't say, here, take this ring, and it's mine, and I want you to be mekadesh this woman with the ring. You can't make a shaliach without a tzivui. And therefore, this guy, you say, it's very dark in here, and I can't possibly read. So you're not making him your shaliach, and you're not even really telling him to do a malachas. So you're not violating medaber davar. You're not violating yisur shlichus. It's just a question of getting hanah from the maisa shabbos. So that's what gets you every time with the hinting, is that you're never going to be able to get hanah. So you could go around camp telling goyim to do every malacha under the sun if you have an intelligent goy who picks up all the hints. So you didn't violate any serum. You just have to make sure that you don't get any benefit from any of these malachos. So what good does that do you? So the only time where it really helps to hint to a non-Jew is when it's not in a significant amount of hana. Not a significant amount of hana. Meaning, you're in here. The lighting in here is not great. So the difference between the lights being off and the lights being on during the day is helpful, but it's not that big of a deal. You can still read everything you want to read without the lights being on. But if it's at night, you can't see anything. So if it would be at night and you would tell the guy, it's very hard to read in here, and the guy understands what you're trying to say and turns on the lights for you on Shabbos, you would have to leave the room. Because you're not allowed to get hana from the fact that the lights were turned on. What? So turning off lights in general might be a different story altogether, because there you're not getting, it's not considered the type of hana that they asked, because it's like a siluk ba'alma, it's just getting rid of something in general. Perhaps we're more lenient with that type of hana, but to turn off, to ask them to turn on the lights, to ask them to, you know, let's say you have cold food that you would not be allowed to eat, you would not be able to eat, you know, and you just couldn't possibly. You couldn't possibly eat it. So if the guy, if you hint to a guy to heat it up for you, that's very nice. You didn't violate any isser of shlichus, but you just can't eat the food. But if it would be the type of food, it's a potato kugel, it's a lakshin kugel, it's chicken. If I have to eat it cold, I'll eat it cold. But I would prefer if it was warm, it would be better. So then it would be, you know, if you hinted to a guy to heat it up for you, that would be much more permissible. Because you're not considered to be getting a significant amount of hana. So that's the idea over here as well. That's when it's mutter to hint to a guy. All right, maybe we have time for one more. Kiddush Hashem is in front of goyim. Right? Kiddush Hashem is in front of goyim. So we're not going to go through the Gemara here, but it's very clear, starting from the Pasuk. What is the Pasuk that teaches us the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem? V'nikdashti b'soch b'nei Yisrael. Right? No mention of goyim. V'nikdashti b'soch b'nei Yisrael. That I'm supposed to be sanctified in the midst of the Jewish people. Right? So I'm supposed to be sanctified in the midst of the Jewish people. Kiddush Hashem is meant to be done in the midst of the Jewish people, not specifically in front of non-frum Jews, not specifically in front of frum Jews. Jews! People who are halachically considered Jewish are the ikar mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem. There is a secondary mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem, which is so the real mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem is outlined in the Gemara in Sanhedrin Ayin Dalet, which is if a goy tells you to violate Navera in public, or a Jew tells you to violate Navera in public, you're not allowed to do it, even a small Navera, and perhaps it extends, perhaps, if you read the Rambam, it's very clear like this, it even might extend to violating one of the cardinal sins. It would be considered a Kiddush Hashem if someone in private asked you to violate Gilui HaRashi V'Chazdam HaVodah Zarah and you didn't do it. That might also be a Kiddush Hashem, and if you did do it, it would be a Chilul Hashem. That's generally speaking, what it means, a Kiddush Hashem or a Chilul Hashem, is when a person does a mitzvah in public, it's a Kiddush Hashem, and when it does an Aveira in public, it's a Chilul Hashem. That's in front of 10 Jews. Sacrificing yourself, that is gufa, the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem. That is exactly what it is. Yeah, it's not, right, Arkas of the Misana. If you look just quickly in source 19, I'll read it to you, if you don't have it, it says, my mitzvah kala. So he says, what is a mitzvah kala? Let me go back one line. Lo amrela bitzina. All the rules of Yehareg Valyavar with the big three were said in private. Al b'far hesya, afilu mitzvah kala Yehareg Valyavar. If it was being done in public, even for a small mitzvah, a light mitzvah, it's Yehareg Valyavar. To violate any avera in public is Yehareg Valyavar. My mitzvah kala, amar Rabbi Rava bar Yitzchak, amar Rav, afilu shanuye arkas in the mesana. Even to change the shoe straps. Right, probably talking about where they had boots that would lace up to the knee. So there's two approaches in the Rishonim. What does it mean, Arkas of the Masana? Something very, very small. Either talking about a minhag, or talking about a minor tznius infraction, which wouldn't even be considered a real tznius infraction, just based on the fact that the Jews were keeping it at the time. So that's what he's talking about over there. And then what's farhesia? What's called doing in a public? So he says, in farhesia, p'chusa me'asar b'nei adam. He's talking about 10 people. And it says, shita yisraelim b'inan. And obviously it means that they're Jews. Right, but there's a secondary type of Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem, which is the Gemara in Yuma, Pei Vav Amid Aleph, which that's the Mishnah in Yuma. The reason it came up was the Mishnah in Yuma says, if we're talking about certain types of Averis, that's the same Mishnah that says Avera Ben Olam Makom, you can do Tshuva and Yom Kippur will be Mechaper, but Avera Ben Olam Chavero, then you need to be Meratzes Chavero, you can't just do Tshuva, it's not enough. And then they say, and Chilul Hashem is so bad that even Yom Kippur won't be mechaper. You have to wait for the Yom HaMisa. So then the Gemara says, Heichi dami chil Hashem, Abaye Omar kidetanya v'haftas Hashem lokecha, sheyehe shem shamayim misahev al yodecha. You should cause Hashem's name to be beloved. Shehi kore v'shoni m'shamish tamidei chachamim v'yehe maso matono benachas im abrios. Right? If you're the type of person who learns Tanakh and you learn Halacha and you learn Gemara and then you act, you speak nicely to people, Ma Brios Omer Alav, what do people say about you? Ashrei Aviv Shalomdo Torah, Ashrei Rabo Shalomdo Torah, Oilohem Labrios Shalomdo Torah, Ploni Shalomdo Torah, Re'e Kama Noim Drachov Kama Mesukonim Maisov. Right? People will say, oh, what a wonderful person. It must be the Torah that they learn that's making them so wonderful. Right? And then on the flip side, it goes further. Person cheats in business despite the fact that they learn Torah. They don't speak pleasantly to people. Right? They say a person who learns Torah and doesn't act properly, is not honest in business, doesn't speak nicely. So people will say, like, oh, what's the point of learning Torah? It's no good. It doesn't do you any good, right? This is the idea of Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem that we're more familiar with. But again, it's very important to keep in mind that when we talk about Kiddush Hashem, Chilul Hashem, and I heard this from a very good source at one point that one of my rabbeim said that when it says that a Jew is supposed to be an Or LaGoyim, supposed to be a light to the rest of the world, it doesn't mean that we're supposed to show the rest of the world that we wear talis and tefillin and that we shake a lulav on sukkis and that we daven three times a day. They don't care. They don't care. Right? It doesn't mean anything. You say to a goy, oh, this Jew is fantastic. Why? Because they pray with such kavana. Who cares? What does that have to do with me? No, when it means things that the goyim will care about, things that will be meaningful to them. You know, if they know that this person, you know, I have a friend like this, I have more than one friend like this, they're very good at their job, and it's understood that when you're around them, since they're respected and very well liked at their job, it's understood that you don't curse when you're around them, and people take it seriously, and sometimes people forget themselves, and they, apparently at the office, you're supposed to curse a lot. So, and from people also, are very mocked with the curse a lot at the office. So, but people understand that around this person nobody curses, and when they do, if they slip up, they apologize to them. They say it's not. We understand it's not acceptable, and we're sorry. You know, because they realize that he's living his life on a higher level. And they say, that must be the Torah, that must be his Judaism that's doing that for him. Meaning, when you act in a certain way, everybody will understand that this is the Torah and mitzvahs that's doing this for you, that's bringing you to this higher level. But just to say, well, yeah, the guy acts like a chaya when he goes to work, but he cheats in business, he does all these terrible things, but he learns up that Talmud really well. Like, what do I care if a guy reads a bunch of Aramaic books? You know, it doesn't mean anything to anybody. Kiddush Hashem means things that people will care about when they see it. And then they'll say, oh, it must be, it's the Torah and mitzvahs that's doing it for him. It must be that Hashem's Torah is an amazing thing because look how the person acts when they follow Hashem's Torah. All right. I have overstayed my welcome. I apologize for that. But everyone have...